Our theme tonight is about the Panama Papers, and it's called Weaponizing the Data Beast. I have a lot to say on this topic. We've gotten a tremendous number of questions over the last week, so you're clearly very interested in it. I think it's a very important story. But I have a lot to say and a lot of little snippets and pieces and stories to gather together because we're just at the beginning and this is going to unravel and unfold for a while here. And it could go in a lot of different directions. My title, Weaponizing the Data Beast. The data beast is a term of art that we used to use at Hamilton Securities, my company in Washington, and it was inspired by the comment from Nicholas Negroponte, the head of the MIT Media Lab. In a digital age, data about money is worth more than money. Whenever we would gather databases that had very powerful information on large amounts of money. These wars would occur, the data wars, and I'd say, ah, the data beast has landed. And we've seen the data beast weaponized with the Panama Papers. And the data wars are upon us globally. Not that they haven't been for a while, but this is a takes it to a new level. As I said, it's going to take a long time to see where this goes, and I want to cover a group of questions and issues. And part of it is not just because of the Panama Papers, but because this use of the data beast and weaponizing the data beast is going to be with us for quite some time. WikiLeaks made an interesting comment. I retweeted it this week. They said, if you censor more than 99% of the documents, you're engaged in 1% journalism by definition, which I thought was very cute because if you look at the initial data dump, and then how much is being disclosed. There's a great deal that's not being disclosed, and so the disclosure is very selective. If I had to guess as to who's responsible, I suspect there's a very good chance that the groups who targeted Hamilton Securities are very much a part of the Panama Papers, essentially a CIA-centric operation, U.S. intelligence agency operation. It could be run entirely by the defense contractors, but ultimately it reports to the deep state, if you will. Okay, first some background stories. I first ran into the Soros interest. Soros is one of the funders for the Open Society Foundation is one of the funders for the Center for Public Integrity, which is the holding company essentially for the affiliate that's launched the Panama Papers. It's a global consortium of journalists and but ultimately it looks like the Center for Public Integrity has taken it under its umbrella and is running the website. I first ran into Soros when my company was targeted within short order and the Department of Justice seized our offices. We finally got it back, but they had literally with an incredible and intense smear campaign and all sorts of false allegations had made it impossible for us to function as a business, so I shut the business down. And it didn't take very long until a sort of inside player who knew me showed up suggesting that I repackage everything that I was doing and take it to Soros and get a grant and do it as a not-for-profit. And I looked at him like he was nuts. Here's what he was saying, because at the time Soros was on the executive committee on the Council on Foreign Relations, and I knew exactly what that meant. I was thinking, oh, great. You basically steal my business, you steal my contracts, you strip my company of all the people, you seize the databases, you steal the software tools, you steal the data, you use that to make financial equity for yourself, and then you take a tiny piece of it and you keep me busy engaged in some not-for-profit thing that goes no place under the auspices begging for money of one of the perpetrators. Are you crazy? Do you really think I'm that stupid? Anyway, I've watched many different uses for foundations and sort of what's called NGOs, and I have always encouraged you to watch the Norm Todd interview with Ed Griffith. Marvelous interview on sort of how the foundations are used. There's also some great examples in Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, sort of about how foundations are used in disaster capitalism. But needless to say, this kind of philanthropy, in my experience, is used to help the pro-centralization team in a whole variety of ways. You could write an encyclopedia about the different ways. So there's no doubt that Soros and that network is present here, just as they were in the Hamilton securities case. Okay, the second story I wanted to tell you is why I refused to go to Panama. When I was litigating and trying to look for a low-cost place to live, I can't tell you how many people, again, insiders, who suddenly showed up and said, "Oh, you should go to Panama." Well, if you look deeply into Panama, which I did, Panama is very much a stronghold of, at that time, it was kind of the CIA and the Bushies. The first Bush administration had invaded Panama, kicked out Noriega, who'd been on the CIA payroll for a long time. And if they didn't control it before, after December 20th, 1989, when the invasion took place, they sure controlled it afterwards. And I realized in pretty short order, oh, if you look at the people on my tail here in this country, if I went to Panama, it'd be that much easier for them to get me. And that's why I always tell people, be very careful about getting away, because you have institutional and cultural protections here that you might not have in foreign lands where you're a stranger. I suspect if I'd gone to Panama, I probably wouldn't be here doing the Salieri Report today. So Panama is a very kind of interesting place, but a very big banking center and one of the strongest growing economies in Latin America. The Center for Public Integrity was founded by a guy named Charles Lewis, who I have great respect for, and it's tried. He and the Center for and he's now retired or not active, I think, at the center, but. If you look at what he tried to do and his successors and the organization, they've tried to do a lot of great things. But I think over time, the establishment and the funding, the rules of funding, have constantly pushed them in ways that marginalize them. And I wanted to tell you a story of one of the first times I saw them marginalized. I went, they had announced that they were doing a big project on transparency globally. And of course, I think the key to real solutions is transparency. So I thought, oh, great, the Center for Public Integrity is going to help do transparency. This is wonderful. I can give them all my place-based financial statement things. So I headed over to a big press event they were doing, and it was either at Brookings or Carnegie, somewhere over in one of the big places in Washington, big think tanks. And they had a very impressive woman leading the whole thing, and they'd done a whole methodology and done all these calculations and ranked this and that, and interviewed millions of or thousands of reporters all around the world and editors, and it, you know, it was a big process and a big research, and where it came out was the United States had the best transparency in the world. It was completely Orwellian, and what you realized is this was a person working entirely in the official reality who was clueless about the whole covert reality or how the money worked, let alone, you know, the covert cash flows. And there was an audience of about 100 people. It was a very global audience with people from all around the world, and everyone was stunned, and no one said anything, and there were almost no questions because it was so bad. You didn't even know what to say, but you realized that, you know, the people doing this were completely clueless. And as such, you know, it's basically George Soros funding the proof positive that America is perfect. Every place else is corrupt. It wasn't quite that bad, but almost. Okay, so a few stories from from what I learned being the target of a smear campaign, not unlike what's happening to some of the people who find themselves targeted through the Panama Papers. The goal of the targeting in a case like Hamilton, or many of the cases you're looking at coming out of the Panama Papers, is the goal is to do irreparable damage and destruction before the target has a legitimate or professional opportunity to address allegations in either a court of law or the court of popular opinion. So you basically want to destroy them and steal whatever you're out to steal before they can do anything about it. It's basically the opposite of the law. Of course, our legal system is based on the principle that an individual or an entity should have the opportunity to address allegations before irreparable harm is done. Well, the goal here is to flip that on its head and do the opposite. And essentially, Mr. Global wants the general population to support this effort to do irreparable harm to whoever Mr. Global targets or has the corporate media target. And that way, Mr. Global gets complete economic control at a very low cost. It's very efficient. So if you can just point to somebody and make up any allegation, and that will do irreparable harm, and the general population will make sure that it does. Wow, what an economic system. And so everyone has to live in terror because the law du jour is whatever the corporate media says it is. And the allegation du jour is capable of destruction, whether it's true or not. It took me 11 years and $6 million to prove it was a phony frame. In fact, it was a series of phony frames. When the first phony frame didn't work, they kept trying to come up with other phony frames. But I'll give you an example of how powerful it is, and because it's very hard to understand until you experience it perfectly, personally. I had a chief financial officer at Hamilton Securities, absolutely excellent. I was when we looked for a chief financial officer, I bought way above what we could afford or really deserve because we wanted to grow. So I wanted somebody of really extraordinary caliber. Anyway, and he was. And one day, when we were being smeared for money laundering, and I was being the allegations or intimations was that I was laundering money, he said to me, he came up to me and he said, "Could I talk to you?" And I said, "Sure." So we went into the boardroom, and he said to me, "You know, I woke up this morning and I said, maybe she is laundering money. I mean, all these people are saying she's laundering money. Maybe she is." And then I realized, you know, you don't sign any checks. Two people have to sign a check, one of which was him. So he signed all the checks. He said, "I control your bank accounts. I control your 401k. I control all the money at the company. You don't sign anything." And then I realized, no, she can't be laundering money unless I'm doing it. And I know I'm not doing it. But it was remarkable. We also had a system where all the cash flows were available to all the full-time employees who were shareholders through the internet. So there was no, you know, there was full disclosure of how the money worked inside the firm with a wide number of people. And I think it was one of the reasons we survived. But it will show you the power of when they turn that machinery on, of how people believe the most ridiculous things. If the machine says it's true, then oh, it must be true. And I used to have to regularly fight with newspapers saying, "Look, this is false, and I can prove it. You have to retract it." And they would say, "Well, we're not going to. Too bad. Sue us." And in one case, we did, but it gets expensive. It was amazing because if you look at the lengths they went to keep me from going to trial. So this idea of you get a chance to address the allegations in a court of law before irreparable harm is done. Well, you know, we were attacked by wave after wave after wave from 1996 to it took me until 2003 to get into court to really address the full allegations, and it went through to 2004. So 2003 to 2004, and every time I insisted, they would try and force me to settle. I wouldn't settle. I'd get poisoned. My car would be followed. They'd break into the house. You know, anything to pressure me to settle. And I refused to because I wanted to go into court and make them come to the table and have to put forward evidence of wrongdoing. And it was amazing because we finally got into court. They canceled the first trial. Where they had to address all the big allegations. They canceled the trial on the eve of trial 3 or 4 times. It was unbelievable. So the lawyers had to keep preparing. It was very expensive. And so finally, we finally got to the point where it was too embarrassing. I wouldn't settle, and they couldn't cancel anymore. And so we walked into court, and it turned out, as I had told my attorneys all along for many, many, many years, at that point, what was it, 4 plus 8, so 7 years. My attorney turned to me and said, "Oh my God, they have nothing. This was a bluff from the beginning." And I said, "I told you." And he was stunned. He couldn't believe that anyone could bluff with so many allegations and so many lies. for so many years, in force, and but they can, and it's quite phenomenal to watch it happen. Anyway, so that's why when you watch these things, you want to be very, very careful, because until somebody has an opportunity to really address allocations in a reasonable way, don't necessarily believe it. Okay, so let's talk about what's happening. There is a line between a leak and a digital break-in and theft and an act of war. A leak is typically not a felony if a government is breaking the law. It's often not a criminal act to leak. This is something different because this was a private law firm. And what happened was a break-in and theft. Now, if you broke into a fur company, stole 1,000 mink coats, and then reporters all over the world were walking around in stolen mink coats, a policeman's, Interpol would come and take all the coats back, right? So that's not happening here. We've had a break-in, we've had a felony, we've had a criminal act, a theft, and the fruits of that theft have been given to reporters all over the world, and they're free to use them and publish them. It's quite remarkable. Where's the enforcement? Where's the law? So this is a break-in and theft, and it's translating into that material being used in weaponized ways, including as an act of war. I would say that what is happening with targeting Putin and people around Putin, that's an act of war. You are trying to destroy and sabotage leaders of another country as part of a political act. And so that's one of the reasons I'm calling this weaponized data. I would note that we saw an article, it's up on the website. The FBI director bragged about his ability to spy on cell phones. Let me read it to you. FBI Director James Comey said the agency purchased a tool from a private party to access data on the iPhone used by one of the San Bernardino shooters. Now, a private party is selling the FBI a tool that will allow it to hack phones. Why is the FBI purchasing it from them? Why isn't the FBI enforcing against them? You've got a company out there selling tools that allow you to hack into private phone calls and private materials. Where's the enforcement here? Let me keep going. Comey, in address at Kenyon College in Ohio, said the legal battle between the U.S. government and Apple ended because the government has purchased from a private party a way to get into that phone running iOS 9 operating system. He said the same method could be used to help the agency and law enforcement nationwide in the future. Really, I wonder how that tool is helping the private party and all the people they're selling it to. I can imagine a world where a local police department, a case they can't otherwise solve, can send us a device with the understanding that we are never going to testify, we're never going to be able to tell you how we opened it, so you're never going to be able to use what's on the phone as evidence, but it might lead to something that would be useful, he said. Needless to say, what he's telling you is there is no privacy and there is no law about privacy. Anyway, it's, we are now facing a situation with complete digital lawlessness. So we're legitimizing a crime, which is hacking and stealing a law firm's data, and we're calling it whistleblowing, when in fact, many of the people in that database and their private documents and their privacy rights have been completely trampled. And as far as we know, there may be many of them who haven't broken any law whatsoever. So stealing and destroying other people's privacy rights is not whistleblowing, it's something else. And I think it's very important to acknowledge that. John McAfee, who's running for president on the Libertarians ticket, said a good thing the other day. He said, without privacy, there is no freedom. And what you see is a group of essentially NGO type players and media entities encouraging the general population to support the complete lawless devastation of thousands of people's privacy rights on private transactions with their private money. Now, some of you may say, well, there's a lot of shenanigans going on that's going to be illuminated by this. And yeah, there probably are a lot of shenanigans. But I just remind you, if the law doesn't protect everybody, then it protects no one. One of my favorite quotes I wanted to read to you again, it comes from A Man for All Seasons, and it's a dialogue between William Roper and Sir Thomas More. Roper says, "So now you give the devil the benefit of the law?" And Sir Thomas More says, "Yes, what would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil?" William Roper says, "Yes, I'd cut down every law in England to do that." Sir Thomas More, "Oh, and when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide, Roper, the laws all being flat? This country is planted thick with laws from coast to coast, man's law, not God's. And if you cut them down and you're just the man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes, I'd give the devil benefit of the law for my own safety's sake." So if this law firm and its clients don't have a right to privacy laws, and we as a general population respect and affirm and support the destruction of their privacy rights, what do you think that's going to translate in terms of what can happen to us and our banking relationships and our relationships and financial institutions and our privacy? So the process is affirming also the complete lack of systems integrity. We are looking at a level of lawlessness in the systems, which is quite remarkable, given that you've got the whole consumer industry running around and planning on distributing everything through the digital systems. Another aspect of this is targeting enemies. So far, we've seen the Prime Minister of Iceland forced to resign. So one of the few people who, or the few politicians in the world who successfully stood up to the international banking cartel and managed to issue the first sovereign cryptocurrency, the Aurora coin, has now been targeted and destroyed. How interesting is that? So, and of course we see the effort to go after Putin and a variety of the sort of New World Order hit list. So expect more of that, but don't for a minute think that the guys are getting targeted are necessarily the bad guys. We're also seeing a competition for business here. There's a great piece in Bloomberg recently about the number one tax haven in the world is the United States. There was a a great cover of Bloomberg Business Week, Reno, the biggest little tax haven in the world, because Nevada is one of the most important states. Let me just read you a quote from that story. So, a lawyer at a Zurich law firm. How ironic, no, how perverse that the U.S., which has been so sanctimonious in its condemnation of Swiss banks, has become the banking secrecy jurisdiction du jour, wrote a lawyer at the Zurich law firm in a recent legal journal. Quote, "That giant sucking sound you hear, it's the sound of money rushing to the USA." Quote. So part of the message here is you want to use Wyoming, Nevada, and South Dakota. You don't want to use Panama. So there's definitely a market share angle. Okay, the next possible angle, which I think is very important, is blackmail. And blackmailing, first and foremost, the 99% in the database who haven't found their way into the headlines. And there could be enormous angles in both the US presidential campaign and all sorts of business deals going down. But this gives you the power to bring tremendous blackmail to bear if a person was associated in any way with deals with that law firm or was a client of the law firm. Another part of this blackmail is not, it doesn't have anything to do with people who could be directly blackmailed. You have to understand that every law firm on the planet is now living in a state of terror after watching this. This, if you're a managing partner or the head of systems at a law firm, this experience is putting you in a state of complete fear. Because I assure you, whoever hacked the Panamanian law firm can hack just about any law firm in the world. We suddenly see, and I've been getting the mailings, cybersecurity firms announcing all of their services and saying, you don't want this happening to you. And so one of the things that's going to happen is this is going to help the cybersecurity services, including those who are part of the investment net, part of the investment syndicates around the people who did this. But imagine if you want a law firm to do something for you or not do something for you, your ability to threaten them with this happening to them, it puts every law firm over the barrel and completely obedient to the powers that are doing these kinds of things. So in essence, you're creating a new powerful enforcement network that it's kind of like the ultimate control files. One of the most important questions of this is which side are the Clintons on? The Clintons have a history with Promise Software, and these kinds of networks. If you haven't read the story of or the history of Promise Software, PROMIS, I recommend it to you. There's a wonderful book by a fictional book by Michael Thomas, former partner of Lehman Brothers, called Black Money, that gives you a sort of interesting, easy to read pulp fiction description of how the software worked. The Clintons could be on either side of this. Needless to say, the person controlling can do a lot of fundraising. I assure you, if you wanted to raise money for a campaign and you control this database, it would be pretty amazing how much money you could get rolling into your super PACs. The day the Panama Papers hit the front page, the Wall Street Journal had an editorial saying that the real scandal around Clinton's emails was not the emails and the compromise of national security. It was a comparison of the emails to what the Clinton Foundation and the president were doing, running around the world racketeering. And if you read Clinton Cash, I absolutely agree. I think that's true. And my guess is if you dug deep enough into this database and you wanted to connect the dots with both the emails and the sort of the racketeering going on between the two Clintons and the Clinton Foundation, I'm sure you could dig up a lot. So if you wanted to have a major scandal and make sure Hillary Clinton got indicted, you could do it. On the other side, as I said, if you wanted to also raise $1 billion for her, you could also do that. So the question is, who controls the database and what's their goal? And I think we'll see how that plays out one way or the other. It'll be very interesting if it dovetails with the FBI's decision as to whether to indict or not. That should happen sometime in the next 60 days. But whoever controls this database has unbelievable power, not just of the people in the database, but every law firm in the world who's afraid it's going to happen to them, and every offshore financial vehicle who's afraid it's going to happen to them. And the definite message is going to be, bring your money home back to North America or else. Another symptom of this, and another important thing to understand in this, is something I've been talking about for several Solari reports now, and we've seen it in the election, and now we're seeing it here on the offshore beat, and that is that the establishment is being re-engineered. Essentially, they're being downside. People who thought they were insiders are waking up and discovering that they're not, they're outsiders. And I think you're going to see the establishment cut down by a very significant percentage. If you read my, I wrote a commentary about the African American elite being in a state of shock over the election, and sort of facing the prospect of the fact that you didn't need a whole lot of people to put a pretty face on things anymore. Essentially, you could work through the system. You had the central control now, and you didn't need their justifying what was going on. So, that means a lot of people in the establishment are going to be in a very insecure state for the next couple of years as this goes on. When I've been dealing with government bureaucracies or large financial institutions, I'm hearing more and more paranoia, and it's the clear message is you can't get anything done in 2.0 anymore, whether it's the business bureaucracy or the banking bureaucracy or the government bureaucracy. People are just too scared, and the regulation has gotten way too complicated. What that means is the 3.0 areas are going to be off and running. They're the ones who are getting the most benefit from lawlessness, and that includes fintech. If you haven't taken a look at what fintech means and what it's doing, do a search for fintech and start to educate yourself. It also means surveillance capital is free to roam. So you're going to have a whole bunch of players over in 3.0 who are very good with the systems. And frankly, they're going to profit and are profiting from lawlessness and the ability to act ahead of law and enforcement, because the law and enforcement hasn't caught up with enforcement in the digital space. The Economist pointed out this week on one of their tweets that one third of internet users use Facebook every day. It's just, sometimes I'm glad I'm a Christian, or I would get really depressed. So, what do we do if we're going to have to depend on systems that have no privacy and no integrity? I think there's a big question here. Will the Anglo-American leadership of financial system continue in the face of these kinds of dirty tricks? Does it kill the goose that laid the golden egg? Clearly not in the short run. In the short run, cash is pouring in. Where it goes in the long run, is anyone's guess. What can you do? Two very important things. First and foremost, please keep redundant and offline records of all your finances, taxes, and other important legal documents. You must be able to prove everything without anything that's online, and you must have copies yourself. So, you can keep them in digital form on a USB stick or, on a CD, but for heaven's sakes, find ways of keeping redundant copies of things in fireproof safes or in safe ways. Do not depend on online sources, and do not depend on the government and financial institutions to provide you with statements when you need them. You're going to have to prove things. If you talk to people who live through disasters, the people who can come up quick are the people who have all their documentation organized and lined up. So that's number one. Please keep redundant and offline records of your financial, legal, and tax documentation. Okay, the second thing, there is no privacy. Let me say it again. There is no privacy. Let me say it again. There is no privacy. And I will tell you how I came to learn how to live in a world where there was no privacy. I was in Washington, and I was living in this beautiful mansion, and another concerned insider came to me to tip me off that I was under 24/7 video surveillance, and they'd hidden video cameras inside my house. For all I know, it was true. I don't know if it was true, but I had to live with the possibility that it was true. And we certainly had 24/7 surveillance and all sorts of 24/7 harassment. And I was contemplating how to adjust to this, and I went to a wonderful sermon at church, and the pastor was all worked up and said, you're worried about what other people think about you, but you need to worry about what God thinks about you. God sees everything you do, God knows everything you do. That's what you need to worry about. And I thought, that is what I need to worry about. And if I worry about that, I don't have to worry about all this other stuff. I just need to keep trying to seek total personal integrity. If you look at my opportunity for improvement, it's a lifelong opportunity. And then I just don't need to worry about any of these other folks. And so I really recommend that to you, is to get your mind off of who's invading your business, and get your mind on, play offense instead of defense. Get your mind on the source of power, and what the source of power that will support you thinks of how you're serving your purpose. So there is no privacy, but there's a way to deal with it, which can take you on a higher mind and get you completely out of the negative space of even worrying about it. Finally, I wanted to read you one paragraph. Peter Apps at Reuters made a very astute comment about the Panama Papers, wrote an editorial. Let me just read you the last paragraph. Even if the new crop of politicians can avoid being implicated in some of the morally uncomfortable dealings revealed by the Panama Papers, that will not itself fix the system. For all its deficiency, the current globalized financial and trading system has helped lift hundreds of millions from poverty in the developing world, even as the wealth gap in almost every individual country has grown. Taming its worst excesses without breaking it entirely will be no easy task. Excellent point. But it's possible, and we're willing for it to work.